This program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Joe Campanelli. I am excited for the show today. But before we get started, I just want to let you know, if you enjoy In the Drink, you can always listen to us on iTunes. And please subscribe. That would be fantastic. Or you can listen to previous episodes on Heritage Radio Network's website, heritageradionetwork.org. com/in the drink. And when you don't find me here as hosting In the Drink, you can always find me at one of our restaurants where I serve as the beverage director. Our restaurants are Del Anima, Lartuzzi, Lapicho, and the Wine Bar and Fora. We recently also just closed up for the summer at Altalinea, where we served a bunch of great wines, frozen Negroni, and some delicious champagne, including Ruinart champagne. And that takes us into our guest here. Very excited to have the chef de cave from Ruinart, one of the greatest houses and certainly the oldest champagne house. Frederic Panayotis is here in-house with us at In the Drink. Welcome to In the Drink, Frederic.
Thank you very much. Bonjour.
Bonjour. What does it mean to be a chef de cave? It sounds very, very fancy. I know a little bit about what you do, but it seems like also something a little bit mysterious. Tell us about what your job actually is.
Well, basically, it's to be the guardian of the temple of the house, meaning you are responsible of, with the team, obviously, of the taste, you know, of the Ruinart champagnes, keeping the style. I would say also preparing the future. I think this is very important to understand, as we are in a business where you prepare wines for your successors. You know, you build, you inherit from the legacy of your predecessors, but you also build the one for the ones who will be taking over one day. So that's the way I could summarize the job. Well, it means that on a daily basis, you work with nature, you work with the grapes, you work with the vines. So you have to be aware of what's going on during the year. One of the most important moments would be the harvest, which took place like a month ago now, where you know, it's still like in a couple of weeks, the whole work in 1 year of the vineyard is transformed into wine, and that's the raw material you're going to work with to blend the wines.
So I've always understood the chef de cave to be someone more who works inside the winery, who's blending the wines. How do you work with the vineyards, and how is harvest such an important time for you?
Well, it's obviously you want to anticipate the harvest, because based on the cycle of the year, you know, every year is different. We're in a region where no year is like another. Or it's probably true in many, many vineyards, but we do, being on the northern side, one of the most northerly vineyards in Europe, there are some great differences from one year to another. So in a warm year, you might not take the same decisions as in a cooler year, because the balance of the grapes might be a bit different. So you have to anticipate that. And obviously during harvest, you have to be fairly quick. You have to take the right decisions when you have to pick the right varieties in the right place at the right time. And it's not always the same from one year to another. So you have to monitor that. You have to see the progression of the maturity. Like this year, we've been very, very happy with what we've done. We've had very stable parameters during the whole harvest, meaning that we choose the good places to start, and we choose the good places to keep on, and the good places to finish.
I obviously speak a lot with Italian producers, and it seems like all over Italy and in many places of France as well. 2015 was like a pretty great vintage. Everyone seems much happier and less stressed than they were
last year.
Than last year,
definitely. Last year, what we call a challenging vintage, which is probably a lousy, in other words. It was a difficult one, and certainly no vintage made at Ruinart. This year was a bit disappointing in terms of quantity. We were like 20% down compared to what we expected. But quality-wise, it was very, very good. We had a very dry season, and that's, you know, took care of the diseases. So we harvested very healthy grapes, and then good maturity levels. Acidity is just a tad lower than usual, but not, you know, nothing to worry about. And we've just started to go through most of the wines from this year as a, you know, first approach, and they taste pretty good. So yeah, we can expect crafting Don Ruinart vintage this year, hopefully.
Great. We'll all look forward to that. And how do you look at the position of your job at the helm of, obviously, the oldest champagne house, the history that you have, maintaining the history and the tradition while also adjusting either to modern tastes or to factors that are outside of the public taste?
Well, we're a team. You have to understand that. So it's the decisions, we take them together. Well, you have a little bit of pressure, but in champagne, who hasn't has pressure, right? There's even pressure in the bottle, so that's not a problem for us. I don't think about it. I don't think about it this way, like having a kind of a pressure. It's just like we enjoy what we do. You know, we work the job we do it with a lot of passion. We don't count the hours. We're happy to go working every day. Happy. We're super excited when it's harvest. Extremely excited when it's time to work on the base wines and blend them together. We've all worked quite a few years in the industry, and so, you know, I think we are taking good decisions. I mean, it shows in the wines. We've had some very good results, you know, like in the past and now recently, and I hope it'll be the same in the future. But that doesn't mean we don't change things. What we want to do when we talk about the non-vintage especially is always go for more purity and more freshness, more elegance. So that's because it's really the style of the Ruinart champagnes driven by the Chardonnay. And as far as our Don Ruinart, the prestige cuvée, is concerned, the idea is to increase that intensity, the toasty character, which is very, very specific in this 100% Chardonnay, this Blanc de Blanc vintage champagne. And for that, 5 years ago, we decided to change the way the wine ages in the bottle. We switched from crown cap to cork. So this is, in a way, it's very interesting. In a way, it's going back to tradition, because that's the way all the champagnes were bottled before for the second fermentation. There was no crown cap until the 60s. But the decision we took was based on 20 years of experimentation that were started way before I started, mm-hmm. because I joined the company 8.5 years ago. So you see how people before you like sort of paved the way, and then you benefit from their experience, and then you build the future. And my, you know, those bottles, hopefully I will see them, because I hope to still be there in 2022 when the vintage Don Ruinart 2010 is released. But hopefully later on, that's the way all the Don Ruinart will be.
Right, and so Don Ruinart spends 9 or 10 years on the lease. Is that accurate?
Between 8 and 10.
8 and 10 years
for the Blanc de Blanc. I mean, for the Don Ruinart Blanc de Blanc, and it can be 1 or 2 years extra for the Don Ruinart Rosé.
Okay, and when you have the crown cap on, I imagine that is a completely or mostly anaerobic environment, right? There's no or very little oxygen getting in, but the cork might allow for a little bit more, and correct me if I'm wrong, but since you have the lees in the bottle, that is creating a little bit of reduction in the bottle, and so it's protecting the wine in a way.
I need to correct a few things.
Okay, great. I love this. Great.
Actually, the crown cap allows some oxygen in, mm-hmm. but you can regulate it by the type of gasket that is used, so it can be more or less permissive to oxygen. All right. So we used to work with like low permeability, because we tend to work in a gently reductive way at Ruinart. We like, I think those toasty character are really coming from that type of aging. Now the cork, the cork allows less oxygen on the long term. Not at the beginning. At the beginning, it has oxygen into it. But on the long term, let's say after 7 years, it tends to be globally allowing less oxygen inside compared to the crown cap, and which is why we decided to go back to cork.
Interesting. Okay.
It also depends on how you store the bottles. If you store them lying on the side, like it's, you know, it's supposed to be, oxygen goes directly from the outside through the or the side of the cork or the crown cap into the wine and allows for a little bit of oxidation, gentle oxidation, but gentle oxidation of the wine. Now, if you riddle the bottle and put them upside down with the deposit next to the crown cap or the cork, then the those lees of yeast will actually act as a buffer and eat the oxygen and basically stop the maturation process.
Wow. So if on the if you have it in surpoint, I guess it would be called totally upside down and the lees are at the top, it just protects and no more oxygen.
Very little. Exactly.
That, see, this is great. It's something that I completely did not know at all. So I really appreciate you you sharing that. I wanted to switch over just for a moment because Ruinart is one of the champagne brands that I find that wine lovers really, really love, sommeliers really love, even in this world where we are being exposed to so many more grower champagnes. I find that my sommelier friends, me included, Ruinart is one of the non-grower champagnes that we keep going back to. Maybe Ruinart and Bilkar Samon are like the two that we love. Why do you think, what is it? Why do you think that is?
I was going to ask you the questions. What,
well, what's different between what you guys do and some of the other, I mean, you're not a very large house, right?
No, we are not. But well, I think maybe the style. I mean, I like to think that the style and the, you know, the taste of our champagnes makes that people happy and they like to come back to us. It's definitely a particular style. The fact that we are going for what I like to call aromatic freshness, you know, non vintages especially. This is something really we work on a lot, and we also try. I will quote the person who took over the company in 1946 after World War II. The gentleman was called Bertrand Mur, and he was from the family, the Ruinart family, and he started with nothing. He had 17 hectares of vineyards from the house. The stock was down to like 800 cases of champagne in the cellar. There was all was left from the World War II. And he's the one who picked the Chardonnay because he liked the freshness. And as he told me once, because I met the guy, he told me, I like my champagne from 9 a.m. until 9 a.m. the next day. Meaning that for him, non-vintage champagne especially had to be, in a way, accessible, drinkable. Of course, with a lot of elegance, with a lot of sophistication and some complexity, but it's, you know, you can have everything if you work well. So this is something that, and being born in Champagne myself, that's the way I see Champagne as well. Something that, you know, a drink that is great for celebration, is great to go with food, is great at any moment of the day and of your life, maybe. So we tend to work hard on getting the right balance, you know, and that starts from the blending process. To make wine that are very pure, very elegant, very fresh, but also with a very creamy, fleshy palate that I think appeals to wine lovers. And I guess that's also maybe why sommelier loves us. Also, we are not in terms of distribution. We like to be in fine retail stores, nice hotels and restaurants. Not that there won't be any mass distribution of Ruinart. So I think that also, you know, is a way to ensure that we are quite exclusive, and so people like to, you know, like to find us.
I understand. And so, what were the factors that led to, just going back to that history after World War II? It's so interesting how Ruinart was maybe on the verge of complete.
Oh, it almost disappeared.
Being disappeared. How did it get rebuilt? Other than this guy who clearly liked to drink champagne a lot.
Well, it took a lot of time. I mean, it's, you know, he was actually the guy had to find partners for the distribution, and that's why it explains something. Ruinart has the oldest history, as you mentioned. We were the first officially established champagne house in 1729, and 1 year after Champagne got the special allowance from the king to bottle wine, because prior to that, bottling wine in Champagne was not legal, meaning there was not officially any champagne, you know, being, or any champagne house, because you just couldn't sell it. What was I going to say? I'm sorry, I lost it. In terms of rebuilding, so we have that old history, but since the house almost, and so at the time, I'm sorry, Ruinart was exporting 90% of its wine to, you know, mostly in Europe, even to the US as early as 1830 for the first time, and then in the 1870s. But in 1946, with only two customers left in Paris, Mr. Mur work on the domestic market. And that explains why, as opposed to many famous champagne houses, Ruinart is still very, very dominant in the French market. We 50% of our wines, even more than that, 55% of our wines are sold in France, not outside. So we are slowly rebuilding the international fame of the house.
Okay, and that's super interesting. I mean, on that note, we're going to take actually just a very quick break, and we'll be back with more.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we are back on In the Drink. We have the Chef de Cave from Ruinart Champagne here in the house with us, Frederic. Welcome back. I did want to move our discussion to a conversation about sustainability. Champagne is a region that is notoriously bad when it comes to sustainability. I've heard stories about
bad. I think Champagne is probably the leading region in the world.
In the past,
we've been bad.
I've heard stories of garbage from Paris the vineyards.
Right, that was until the 70s, even 80s. Yeah, but it's you can still see some of those. Effect, but it's, you know, this is long gone. And it's true that we had to get a few wake-up calls, serious wake-up calls, and that made the region change quite a few things in terms of even, you know, laws to make sure that those things won't happen in the future. Champagne has been quite preeminent, and that thanks to the CIVC, mm-hmm. the interprofessional body of Champagne that has studied the champagne, that has seen champagne as a global industry and see how it could reduce its impact on green gases emissions. And what's interesting on this is that contrary to what people think, if you viticulture out of 100% impact on green gas emissions, viticulture is only about 11%. And winemaking is only about 9%. So together, you only have like 20% of your green gases emission there, as opposed to, let's say, packaging and shipments that can go up to 35%. So if you want to be sustainable or reduce your green gases emissions, the impact on working on like reducing your packaging, reducing your, the weight of the package and stuff like that will be way more efficient than reducing, you know, your green gases emissions in the vineyard. I mean, you have to work on all the targets, But the, it's easier to have a big impact on packaging, for instance. And so this is a few things we've done seriously at Ruinart. What we call the eco-conception of the packaging, like making sure that there's a double life, that everything is recyclable, that you use elements that are also, you know, like the papers or everything comes from sustainable forests and stuff like that. And just to give you an idea, there's a scale from 1 to 10 on like, it's called the index of mm-hmm. eco-conception. Anything below 7 won't, is not allowed to be developed. And actually the last packaging we've done is 9.2 out of 10. So it's not, like, you know, we can always aim for the best, but we've progressed immensely just in that field. Now, in terms of viticulture, there's a few interesting things that, as well. 75% of our vineyard is, has some, cover crop. We use sexual confusions in the vineyard. That's mm-hmm. a good way to reduce the use of insecticides because we're in a northern vineyard. We do have problems with powdery mildew, downy mildew, botrytis, especially botrytis, and moth are actually notorious to be responsible for bringing botrytis. If you have the moth putting some eggs and then the caterpillars will actually eat some of the grapes, and that's a... That's a, an entry point for the botrytis during during harvest. So if you reduce the moths and you reduce, you know, the eggs, and then you will have less botrytis. And one of the good way to reduce the influence of moth is to prevent them from mating. So what you do is like in the springtime, you put pheromones in a little plastic container in the vineyards, but you have to do it on a large scale. And those pheromones will confuse the male. They won't be able to find the females because they are saturated with, you know, the whole field is saturated with pheromone, and that's usually how they find females. So they won't be able to mate, and so female won't lay any eggs. So that's you know, it's been quite efficient. What I like about it is, like, you have to work... You can't be working alone. You have to work with the other growers. Mm-hmm. You have to work on a village or even on a region scale to make it efficient. So it really, like, pushes the other people... to go into that system and have that mentality for the future.
And so you'd say that this problem with the moths and botrytis or downy mildew, powdery mildew, those are kind of the most severe risks that you guys face in the vineyard.
Right.
And then dealing with those in a sustainable way are kind of the most important things. And there are ways to do it sustainably. I mean, I've been really happy to see how many... champagnes I've been tasting recently that have been made in a more organic or sustainable way, and it seems like more often than not that the newer producers are doing it. And so when you're taking such a holistic approach, especially being an established producer, I'm sure that's making quite an impact.
It does, and we wonder, as we say, you know, if you're a region and have maybe five or six people that mm-hmm. are leading that, but they are very small. And they might be the best in the world, being in terms of sustainability. It won't change the whole picture, but if the whole region changes its habits to a certain level, then the impact is way bigger, and that's what we want in Champagne. And as one of the leading house, but we're not the only one. We definitely have to be like an example for the other ones.
And you think this is the future? In Champagne.
There's no choice.
Yes.
It's the future for all of us. So, and as the Champagne region, I think we represent a lot of values. The world Champagne is just magic. So we have to be the best in the world, no doubt.
And can you explain what the CIVC is and how you work with them?
The CIVC is the interprofessional body of Champagne. It has a few missions, including one is well known, which is the protection of the name Champagne. It's also keep tracks of the ownerships of the vineyards and the shipments, and so there's some legal stuff and administrative stuff. But it also has a technical department in viticulture. Environment mm-hmm. and enology, and so what we do quite often is we work with them. Like we say, okay, we would like to work on this topic, but maybe we don't have, you know, it's not us only, it can benefit the whole Champagne, so we would like to work together on that specific topic. I spent 5 years of my earlier career at the CIVC working on like reeling cycles, corktains,
bunch of things, and it's an excellent team, and especially on environment, they've been working really hard and you know, leading the region to be better.
Yeah. Well, you're a perfect person to ask this then. Why is it that you so rarely get a corked bottle of champagne?
Actually, you do as much as any other wine.
Do you really? You just don't notice it as much?
I'm not sure. I think the, you know, I mean, we. What Champagne has done, and I was happy to be part of that, of those tests, is we've developed tests, like control tests on the cork. So most of the houses, quite a few producers, do these tests where you use some corks, put them with water, taste them after a week, and that allows you to eliminate really bad batches. So I think we don't have that much now in Champagne, but we happen to stumble once in a while on a cork bottle. Maybe people are, they don't see it because they, you know, they ship. The thing with champagne, you have to realize that more often than not, it's tasted in not the best conditions. Like people are standing up, they don't have the right glass. They you know, it's like kind of a party, a cocktail, and they don't pay a lot of attention to what they have in the glass. Most often, it's not the right condition. If you sit down, if you take like what we have here now, some real wine glasses, and take the time, like whether, you know, it's for lunch or dinner or like a city aperitif, then it's a different picture. And then you see the wine behind the bubbles. So that's something we would like to, you know, push more and develop more in the future. Obviously, sommelier, that's their job to help us to do that. And we are very grateful for their action.
Yeah. Wow. You're welcome on the the part of all sommeliers. Now, did you want to taste the champagne that you brought here?
So we brought the Dorwino.
Wow.
2004. This is the current vintage of Dorwino. It's 100%. Chardonnay. This is a tribute to the monk Don Thierry Ruinart, who was, you know, sort of the inspirator of the house. The first vintage was made in 1959. We are missing that first vintage at the winery, so that's something I'm saying here to anybody listening. If you ever find a bottle of Dorwino 59, please contact the house, and you'll be very, very well treated, believe me.
Wow.
From the beginning, this was made with 100% Chardonnay grapes from Grand Cru vineyards. Mm-hmm. And so we use two different regions. We use the Côte des Blancs region, 72% in that particular blend. But we also use Chardonnay from the Montagne de Reims, very close to Reims, where the city, where the winery is located, and particularly the Grand Cru of Sillery. That is very special, and it brings a bit more power and intensity to the final blend.
And what years did this Dom? Oh, can you guys hear that? That's awesome. What years did this did your Dom live?
He died in 1709, I believe. So quite a few years before the winery got started. But he was not a winemaker at all. He was a philosopher, a writer. And became a dom. You know, to become a dom, which is dominus in Latin, you have to be a master at something. And you know, this guy had a recognition of his monk colleagues, and you know, that's how he got that special title. So, but he's the one who told his family, especially his brother, that champagne could be a business to look at the future, when the Ruinart family at the time was mostly into fabrics.
Yes. And was he a contemporary of Dom Pérignon, or he was before?
He was at the same time. Yes. And they actually met briefly at the Abbey of Auvillé, and that's where Dom Ruinart passed away. And so they are actually buried almost next to each other in the same abbey.
That's crazy. The 2004 vintage. Is this your current release?
It is a current release. Wow. A beautiful year. A year that tended to be a bit shy a few years before release, when we were monitoring the wine. From the winery. Fairly large crop in Chardonnay, but wines with a beautiful beautiful elegance, more elegant than powerful, I would say, compared to, let's say, 2002, which might be more of a famous vintage for Champagne. But the 2004 have that special sort of minerality, beautiful precision, when 2002 is a bit bigger. But I tend to like this kind of purity even better.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's already so complex, especially considering you just, you know, just released it, but it does have 11 years of age on it. And I can, I think I'm answering my own question as to why sommeliers like it so much. Just drinking this right now, it's so complex, great acidity, but not too much. It's just really integrated, and it creeps up on you slowly. And I love this wine. This is beautiful.
Thanks. Well, you know, this is the work of my predecessor. So that's what I've been living with so far. And I you know, obviously, extremely happy to benefit from such a good work.
One last question I wanted to ask you. I should have asked it earlier on. So you do a lot of work tasting Von Clair, right? This is
the moment, actually. We've done a first run, and we'll be doing a second run very soon.
I have tried some Von Clair in my life, and it is so insanely acidic, not, you know, not terribly complex yet. It amazes me that you can taste these wines. How do you go about it? Do you have some system that you have? What are you looking for in the wine that you can taste it and blend the different Von Clairs together and then understand what it's going to be like after 8 to 10 years on the lees and eventually turn to that? How do you do that?
I guess it's experience. I've been working in that field for 28 years myself. And you slowly, you know, work year after year, and that's the way you learn. But you have to understand that when we taste Von Clair, we would typically taste 20 or 25 at the same time, so we can compare them, you know. It might seem difficult when you come from the outside and you only taste like 4 or 5 of them, because they are acidic, they are pretty close, they're not very friendly, to say the least. But when you have like 20 different samples in front of you, you can see the differences, mm-hmm. maybe a bit better. And we also have the memory. You know, we taste Von Clair 3 to 4 months a year, so that's almost a daily task to us. And when it comes to, let's say, Don Ruinard, I would say it's almost the easiest blend to achieve, because if the year is not there, if we're not super happy with the vintage, we just keep it. We just don't make it. And then if the year is great, then we will select... First, we will only select Grand Cru, so that's mm-hmm. you know, already sort of narrows the selection. And then we will select among these, the few tanks we've had, I mean, maybe 10 or 20 tanks of those Grand Cru, we will take the one that we think have the best potential, the best balance and the best potential. And honestly, maybe because it's our work, but we don't find that impossible to do. I mean, we actually find it pretty easy. The non-vintage, on another hand, that requires a lot more work, because you have to remember how it tasted the year before, and you have to make it consistent from one vintage to another, from one year to another, from one harvest to another. So we blend reserve wines with the new wines. We have to work with different origin of the grapes, and achieving consistency for the non-vintage Ruinard Blanc de Blanc takes, you know, a lot more work from us. So in a way, we are more proud of the non-vintage, even though it's less expensive than the Don Ruinard. Than the prestige cuvée, but hey, we're happy to drink Don Ruinard every day.
If I could drink it every day, I'd be a very, very happy man. Frederic, thank you so much. It has been such a joy to have you on the show, and I really applaud your works for your work in sustainability and continuing the tradition of high quality Ruinard. I continue to love these wines, and it is really exciting to have you on the show. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to all the Somme supporting us. And if this is an invitation, if you happen to come to France and be in Paris, we are very very close to Paris. It only takes like 45 minutes by train to go there, and we have amazing cellars, the only one that are classified as a historical monument of France. And as we say, it always tastes better at the source.
Yes. So 11 kilometers of cellars? Is
8 kilometers, 5 miles.
5 miles of champagne underground.
Yeah.
And if you have a bottle of 1959 Dom Ruinard,
you can drink everything that's in there.
It's All right. Thank you again
so much.
It's been such a pleasure. And thank you so much to our producer, Joy Morales, and our engineer, Jack Inslee. You guys are the best. Thank you so much for putting this together. Thanks, guys, for listening. Yep.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.